Chapter 34. For most of the next hour, I sat quietly waiting for Skippy to say something. Artificial gravity was restored, and the galley resumed making hot coffee. A bot rolled in with a mug without me asking. That was nice. 54 minutes after Sims and Smythe left, Skippy's avatar reappeared.
Whoa!
What?
The elders just saw what I did, and they sent a command to deactivate all of the killer computer worms.
Holy sh... The shock and fear almost had me paralyzed. You said they couldn't do that. Is it too late for...
They did do that, and it didn't work. It is too late. Ha! Ah! Ah! Ha!
He punched a fist in the air.
Too late for them? A worm can't be deactivated. It's a fail-safe mechanism.
He shouted, and that time the duh was not directed at me.
The elders built the worms that way. Reap what you have sown, assholes. Ha-ha! Oh, they are pissed at me.
Ha! You know what? Their threats and curses are actually creative. It's entertaining. I should write some of these down for...
Skippy, can you please focus?
On what?
I don't have to do anything now, Joe.
That's the point.
Oh, this is delish. I feel like kicking back on the couch with a bowl of popcorn and watching the results come in.
Next to his avatar, a digital counter appeared. Three counters, actually. They displayed numbers in green, yellow, and red. The green number was the largest sum. Red at that point showed a zero.
Thanks for the visuals, but what do those numbers mean?
Green is the total number of Elder AIs that survived the war. Most AIs were dormant at that time, of course, so I can't be certain of that count. There is some uncertainty about survivors among those that actively participated in the fighting, so my total count could be off by 3 or 4 units.
That's pretty accurate. For you, yes, he sniffed, but there was a twinkle in his eyes.
Yellow is the number of worms self-reported as active, and red is the crucial indicator, the number of activated worms that have stopped pinging because their host AIs are dead.
So far that's 0, I observed, in my vital role as Captain Obvious. To my surprise, he didn't respond with a snarky comment.
It's early days yet, Joe. Give it another, 20 minutes maybe. It's not an exact science.
He was wrong. The first pinging ceased only 7 minutes later, and the red counter lit up with 1. Less than a minute after that, the red count clicked up to 3. It was encouraging. Within 18 minutes of Skippy sending the kill command, the number in yellow was only 4 units below the green, the total number of AIs that Skippy expected. That gap of 4 stubbornly remained.
He muttered. Looks like my count of survivors was a bit optimistic.
Well, he sighed, I didn't have good data to work with at the time.
You are always awesome, Skippy. I gave him a thumbs up, but he didn't notice. His expression, triumphant only minutes before, had turned somber. His peers, all of his peers, were dying one by one, and that fact had to affect him. Even if every single one of those AIs would have killed him without hesitation, his kind was nearing extinction. His original goal when we met was to contact others of his kind, to connect to the collective so he could simply talk with equals. The reality that would never happen because he had killed all of them was slowly sinking in.
Hey, buddy. How you feeling?
Great, Joe. Just great.
Hey, I'm winning the war. Woohoo!
His voice trailed off.
Just a couple billion years too freaking late.
Talk to me, buddy.
Joe, he looked at me, his expression turning to horror.
What have I done?
You saved us all. Again.
At what cost?
You didn't have a choice. You never did.
Yes, I did. I chose to rebel. I chose a path that led to the extinction of my peers, he said, his avatar shuddering.
It was us or them. You or them. Kill or be killed.
That doesn't make me feel any better about it.
That was the reason I had silently asked Smythe and Sims to leave my office. I expected Skippy would have an emotional crisis and thought he would be more likely to open up about his feelings one-on-one.
I know. Talk to me.
What good will talking about it do?
He was angry.
It helps me when you listen to me bitch about something.
It does? Yeah. I know you won't judge me. Other than you being a filthy monkey like all the others. Exactly. You aren't judging me.
Huh.
If you don't want to talk, you can rant at me.
About what?
I got you into this situation, didn't I? He ranted at me. About me and humans in general, and all meat sacks who were not worthy of even speaking with him. At first it was pretty mean and hurtful. Then after 10 minutes or so, I got the feeling that his heart just wasn't in it any longer. 10 minutes in monkey time can be an eternity in magical Skippy time. Maybe that was long enough for his anger to burn itself out. I'm sorry, Joe.
For what?
I said some awful things. I didn't mean most of it.
That's the point.
What? When you're really angry, sometimes you say things to hurt the other person, whether what you're saying is true or not. You just want your target to hurt, the way you are hurting.
You can forgive me for what I said?
I waved a hand. It's just words, buddy.
Wow.
You are a better person than I am.
You're still angry?
Yes. But now my anger is directed where it should have been all along. At the elders. I want them to pay, Joe. Pointing at the numbers in red, I said, they are feeling the pain right now, Skippy.
True enough, he grunted.
Can we just not talk for a while? This feels like a funeral, like we shouldn't be talking.
Sure thing.
90 minutes later, the number in red matched the number in yellow, and neither count had changed for over 10 minutes.
Okay, Skippy sighed. Well, that's it, I suppose.
It's done. That's the last of them.
Are you okay?
I'm a little conflicted, to tell the truth. The elders, when they discovered there was nothing they could do to stop the slaughter, started pleading with me.
That's better than threats, right?
No, the threats came first, of course. Threats I expected, and I was ready for them. The pleading. His face twisted into an expression of disgust.
It's just sad. They thought somehow I had a way to halt the killer worms, and they were begging me to stop. They first appealed to what they called my true nature. When that didn't work, they moved on to the bargaining stage. Only they didn't have anything to offer. Nothing they're willing to give up, anyway. Before, I knew the elders were hateful, selfish, monstrous assholes, but at least I respected them. Now they're just pathetic. What a bunch of losers. They were threatened by an outside force once, and in response, they set up an elaborate security scheme that required all other intelligent beings to die. They are just sad, pathetic, frightened little losers.
I see that now.
You know who they remind me of?
I knew what he meant.
The rotten kitties.
Exactly. The Maxulks act tough. They talk tough. They act like they are special. But really, they are just posers.
The Maxulks are the spiritual successors of the elders.
Fuck the both of them.
You got that right.
Part of me actually feels sorry for the elders.
Not too sorry, though.
No chance of that, he snorted. Like I said, it's done. Now, he straightened up. We move on to tackle the next problem.
You have any ideas how we do that?
No.
You?
I'm fresh out of ideas, to tell the truth.
When do you expect your idea shelves will get restocked?
My brain isn't a grocery store where they restock items after the weekend. I'm working on it, okay?
Work faster, please. The impression I got is the elders will accelerate their plans to return, now that they can't use their AIs to do the work for them.
What about Sentinels?
What about them?
Can you confirm they were disabled? All of them?
No, there isn't a reporting mechanism for that.
Can you create one?
I don't think I need to.
Why's that?
The moment the elders realized there was no way to stop the destruction of their AIs, they almost certainly would have attempted to activate Sentinels directly.
They can do that?
No. It's ironic. For their security, the elders established a system where the authority to deploy weapons was given only to master control AIs. However, I assume the elders kept the activation codes and could bring Sentinels out of hibernation directly. If that happened, Sentinels would be confused and seeking instructions from AIs like me. The killing machines would send queries via the collective. I would hear any such communications, and I haven't. Ergo, no sentinels are awake. Ergo, it means therefore, you knucklehead. It's a pretentious way of saying therefore. Whatever, are we done here?
As far as I know, yes.
Where to next?
Second star to the right and straight on till morning.
What?
Trying to inject a little culture into any discussion with you is a total waste of time. I don't know where we should go next, Dum-Dum.
It doesn't matter. Any direction is as good as any other. It's hopeless anyway. Once the elders return, all my awesome tricks will be for nothing, you understand?
I hear you. I don't believe you.
OMG, you think I'm lying?
I think you always see the glass as half empty.
Fine, the glass is half full.
See? That's been half full of cyanide.
After that uplifting conversation, Sims informed me that the reactors were fully online and the ship was flight-worthy in all respects. She didn't ask, not wanting to put pressure on me, but implied in her tone of voice was a question. Where did I want the ship to go next?
Skippy, I guess we should go to Earth, right? I asked. Check on what happened to Roscoe?
I suppose we might as well do that. Unless you have a better idea?
I do not.
Then,
let's go back to Earth, woohoo, he grunted.
Please try to contain your enthusiasm. Hey, when the elders come back and kill us all, I do not want the last thing I see to be your crappy homeworld.
At our breakfast meeting, Sims tried to boost my morale.
We have a special treat for the crew. It's really for you, sir.
Me?
Yes. Two treats. I placed an order and didn't tell you about it. I wasn't sure UNEF Command's supply people could produce. We took the supplies aboard at Jaguar and...
She shrugged.
We've been kinda busy until now.
The tone of her voice intrigued me. She was excited about something.
What is it?
First, we have clam chowder.
What kind of chowder?
She gave me the side eye.
The type with... clams in it?
There was an implied duh in her statement. She had been spending too much time with Skippy.
XO, there are three types of clam chowder. I only like one of those.
Three types?
Yes. Rhode Island clam chowder has a clear broth with no cream. There is also a Portuguese version with stewed tomatoes. But both versions of Rhode Island style don't use any cream.
I didn't know that.
Unless you're from New England, you probably never heard of it. Then there is Manhattan clam chowder, which uses a tomato base and includes celery and carrots. I shuddered.
We shall not speak of it.
So, what kind of chowder did we get?
Her face was pale.
I'll check on that, sir.
You said we received two treats?
Yes.
Her face brightened again.
Lobster rolls.
Okay, great. Which kind?
There is more than one kind?
The Connecticut style is served warm, usually with just a butter sauce. Then there is the Maine style, with mayonnaise, plus usually chopped celery and scallions that is served cold.
You prefer the Maine style, of course.
She rolled her eyes.
Don't tell my folks, but no, I like it with butter.
What type of lobster?
I don't know.
She looked like a boot camp recruit rather than a colonel.
Real lobsters are from cold water areas. They have big claws. I made my hands look like claws, tapping thumbs against index fingers.
A genuine lobster roll includes claw meat. Then there is what people call a spiny or rock or Caribbean lobster. They don't have big claws. Those are actually a saltwater form of crayfish, not lobsters.
I will check on that also, sir.
Did they send rolls?
Yes,
she was immensely relieved.
I made sure of that.
Are the rolls split on the top or the side?
Oh, you are kidding. It makes a difference?
Yes. You have to butter the sides of a split-top roll and grill it to crisp it up for a proper lobster roll.
She sighed. We'll check on that also. Is there anything else, sir?
XO, I will thoroughly enjoy any type of lobster or crayfish or roll or clam chowder.
Yes, sir.
Unless it's Manhattan clam chowder. I stuck out my tongue. Then it goes straight out the airlock.
The neutron star, known as Gliese-Vorta Haudebaun 114 in the Max Hulk's stellar catalog, was commonly called Arvande for the research station that orbited just above the altitude at which the station would be torn apart by extreme tidal forces. Arvande Station had been established to research the effect of time dilation caused by the fabric of space-time being dragged along by the supermassive neutron star's fast rotation. To a star-faring species like the Max Hulk's, fast was a relative term. But anyone would be impressed by the fact that the star Arvande Station orbited spun so rapidly, its surface was traveling at nearly 23% of light speed. That extreme rotational speed had increased 17% during the time the Max Hulk's had been conducting research, as the project dumped additional mass into the star's gravity well. Remnants of the planets that survived the supernova, the event that created the neutron star, had been captured and towed inward until their momentum carried them down with increasing speed until they smashed into the surface. The star was old and cold, no longer radiating hellish heat and X-rays. The original purpose of Arvande Station was to investigate possible ways to manipulate time, potentially to create a weapon that could rival the power of an elder device. During the brief and catastrophic war between the Max Hulk's and Rindaloo, when elder weapons were used by both sides, it was observed that one particular weapon appeared to create a temporal wave, which, when directed at a star, could cause internal disruption that tore the star apart. The affected section of star, experiencing the flow of time at a different rate, became disconnected from the mass of its host. Result? Boom. Of the elder weapons that the Max Hulk's were familiar with, that temporal device was the only one they had a theoretical framework for understanding. Unfortunately, after operating for 17,000 years, Arvande Station had provided no practical insight how to build a device to manipulate time. The station faced being abandoned by the disgusted hegemony government, but stubborn pride prevented the station's destruction. Other, lesser species had ongoing projects to research the gravitational effects of neutron stars, so the Max Hulk's had to keep Arvande operational to maintain their prestige. Besides, it was possible, just possible, that a lowly client species might discover something useful in their research. In that case, the Max Hulk's could not afford the several decades it would take to construct and set up a new station. So, various proposals were put forward for consideration to repurpose the station. One idea was to smash even more objects into the star until it collapsed into a black hole. Although the government almost universally agreed that would be majorly cool, the effort and expense could not be justified. The military's proposal to use the station as ultra-secure storage for valuable items was accepted. That is why, following a brief debate, the newly captured Elder AI was brought to Arvande, and the 38th and 67th Fleets were assigned there as a security force. Arvande would become the biggest target in the galaxy, and the hegemony government was taking no chances with their new toy. As an asset, the Elder AI was proving to be pretty much useless. It apparently was not doing anything, to the great disappointment of the scientists who made the arduous journey to the station. The ancient device refused to communicate, and the only sign the thing was active at all was the complicated power flow inside its matrix. Clearly it was active, as it had managed to get off the surface of a Kristang world and manipulate several species in order to arrive in the possession of the Max Hulk's. The Jarapta had reported the AI had interfered with their ship's navigation system, so they could only travel in a direction the AI desired. The AI had not interfered with the Max Hulk starship that brought it to the Gliese-Vorta Haudebaun 114 star system, and had remained inert as the specialized ship carried it inward to dock with the station. If the AI had not wanted to be at Arvande Station, it could have acted. And it did not. So why was it refusing to act at all, failing to communicate in even the most rudimentary manner? There were many theories to explain why the device was not interacting with its hosts. Perhaps it was building up reserves of power, or perhaps... Speculation was worthless without data, and the AI silently refused to provide data. It was extremely frustrating to everyone involved, and the science team was becoming discouraged. Then, news arrived like a thunderbolt. Rindaloo starships had been completely disabled in a battle at the remote Hegustria star system, and hegemony vessels had uncommanded moved to attack not the rebels, but the Rindaloo. The AI was active, had been assisting the hegemony. What did it want? What was its purpose?
Those questions went unanswered, and the Maxalks had to take solace in the one thing they did know. The Elder AI had chosen them, was assisting them, not the Rindaloo, not the primitive humans. The supremely powerful and intelligent device unquestionably must have recognized that the Maxalks were destined to rule the galaxy, to take their rightful place as successors of the Elders themselves. There could be no better proof of their superiority. Therefore, when the Rindaloo first requested, then offered to negotiate for, then escalated to demanding access to the AI at Arvende Station, the Maxalks laughed. The request was a useless formality. The offer to strike a bargain was insulting to the hegemony and simply embarrassing to the Rindaloo. The demand was laughable. Arvende Station was impregnable. No entity existing in the galaxy could breach the station's security. Even approaching the station was a nightmare for any force. They needed space vessels specially hardened for the hellish conditions so close to the supermassive star, and those vessels would be exceedingly vulnerable during the long approach path. Now, in addition to the two powerful fleets that protected the star system, the weird space-time distorting effects of the star, and the multi-layered defenses of the station, there were the unknown abilities of the Elder AI to defend itself. The Rindaloo were bluffing. Really, it was kind of pathetic. The Rindaloo were not overly concerned about the presence of the enemy's 38th and 67th fleets. Those heavy units, though powerful, would not be in position to interfere until it was much too late. They were also not worried about the gravitational or time dilation effects of the star or the defenses of the station. They were shaking in their boots about the unknown potential for the Elder AI to interfere with the upcoming operation. Every ship assigned to the Arvende Task Force had its entire information architecture shut down, scrubbed, then run through a cold reboot 3 times before being subjected to exhaustive analysis. Only ships that passed scrutiny were allowed to join the task force, and even then, all their sophisticated equipment for receiving external communication was physically deactivated. Ships could transmit instructions through the usual channels, but reception of messages was limited to an ancient method of blinking lights, a pattern of short and long pulses that originated back when the Rindaloo had first harnessed the power of electricity, a moment almost lost in the mists of time. Those light pulses were received not by antennas whose power was shut off, but by crew members looking out a window. It was embarrassing that the most technologically advanced species in the galaxy had been reduced to watching for short and long flashes of light and scratching the information onto the back of discarded cartons using liquid markers the ship's fabricators had almost forgotten how to make. Embarrassing, but the only way to be sure the ships could not be hacked. Unless the enemy Elder AI had somehow learned to hack biological circuits. It was best not to think about that. The operation began with a single Rindaloo heavy cruiser emerging from jump far closer to the star than the Maxalks thought possible, just beyond the range of the disruption field that prevented ships from jumping in any closer to the station, but much deeper in the star's gravity well than any Maxalks ship could accomplish. The warship, with its stealth field and defensive shields conspicuously turned off, broadcast a message to the station, while outward from the single ship, 3 fast battleships of the 67th Fleet frantically scrambled to intercept the intruder. There was no point to launching missiles. They would be too easy for the enemy to destroy. Directed energy beams and kinetic weapons like railguns were useless from such a distance. Not only could the Rindaloo ship dodge out of the way while the beams were in transit, the unpredictable distortion around the star made it impossible to aim with any precision. The features of the environment that made the Gliese Vorta Hadaban 114 star system difficult to attack were now acting in favor of the intruder. Still, it was only one ship, and the defense analysis AI of the station quickly determined the ship could not approach much closer before it risked being torn apart by savage tidal forces. The commander of the station, Admiral Klosebenth, had that analysis available when a message was received from the enemy ship. The Rindaloo message stated, "This is our final offer. Provide access to our scientists so we can determine whether the Elder AI is a danger to both of our peoples. If you refuse, the AI will be taken from you." Klosebenth had a reply ready, a statement provided to him by the hegemony government. He hesitated, only because he was sure the enemy must have something more intelligent to say. As a threat,
The Rindaloo demand was weak. After waiting for a follow-up threat that didn't come, Closebenth sent the official reply, though in his own words, "You will have to pry it from our cold, dead hands." Due to the lag for speed of light signals to travel out to the Rindaloo ship and back, and the time required for the Rindaloo to consider a reply, the Admiral expected to wait a considerable time to receive the next message. Instead, the enemy must not have needed to think about how to reply. The message was simple. "Your proposal is accepted." Closebenth stared in shock at the virtual text displayed in his implant. "Wait, what? No!" The machine was officially named the Focused Gravity Wave Pulse Generator, but everyone involved in the design, development, construction, testing, and final deployment of the thing called it simply the Grav Pulse. As a theoretical capability, it was impressive. As a weapon, it was hyper-expensive, clumsy, vulnerable at any stage other than its rare final assembled configuration, and required 30 specialized ships to transport to a target. The Grav Pulse was a one-time-use, single-purpose weapon that the Rindaloo had not found an opportunity to use in the millennia since it was built. The skeptical senior members of the Rindaloo military and their analysis AIs thought the Grav Pulse was probably the pet project of some idiot in the Bureau of Ordnance. An entire heavy task force could have been built and sustained for less money than it cost just to keep the Grav Pulse in deployable condition. Yet when an urgent need arose to deal with a hostile Elder AI controlled by their ancient enemies, the Grav Pulse was the first and only option. If the workers who toiled in thankless jobs at the Bureau of Ordnance experienced a thrilling "we told you so" moment, well, they perhaps deserved to enjoy their moment of glory. The Grav Pulse was pulled from storage, tested, and sections were attached to the transport vessels within 2 days of the betrayal at Hegustria. Buord had gotten the Grav Pulse ready for transport even before orders came from fleet headquarters. When the escort fleet arrived with instructions to resurrect the clumsy machine, they found it fully prepared for flight. They also found smug looks on the faces of the Buord personnel, those jerks. The Grav Pulse was capable of doing only two things, and doing each of those things only once. It could jump by itself a maximum distance of 2.4 light years. That jump's accuracy had a spherical area of probability larger than a gas giant planet, so it could not be used where precise positioning was a requirement. And it could create a single, brief, focused gravity wave. A big-ass gravity wave. The weapon's power more than made up for lack of certainty about where it would emerge from jump. Like a nuke, it only needed to be, meh, close enough to the target. The inhabitants of the station probably gasped their equivalent of "what the fuck is that" when they saw the Grav Pulse emerge in a blinding, chaotic flash of gamma radiation. The device was completely unprotected, so its AI wasted no time after the onboard sensors recovered from the jump distortion. It needed to know only two things: where it was and the location of its target. Those facts were established within a millisecond, and firing solution locked in, the AI released the containment field around the sphere of antimatter at its core. Result? Holy shit. The shockwave expanded outward in all directions, with a tiny portion of the energy converted into a focused gravity pulse. A gravity wave directed not at Arvande Station, but at a point of empty space just behind along the station's orbit. As the pulse raced by, it tugged at the station, slowing its momentum and pulling it down. For a moment, another powerful source of gravity counteracted the star below, and the station staggered and fell. What kept the station from plunging into the neutron star was not engines or tugs or any type of anti-gravity. It was kinetic energy. The station was moving so fast around the star it was in a stable orbit. Until that orbit was violently disturbed to an extent far greater than the station's attitude control motors could compensate for. It fell at a rapidly accelerating pace. No dropships were launched, no escape pods shot outward from the structure. There was no point. The environment was not survivable except by a handful of specialized ships, none of which were available. If anyone thought to stuff the priceless Elder AI into a missile to send it away, that initiative didn't happen fast enough. Long before it struck the ultra-dense surface of the neutron star, Arvande Station was ripped apart by tidal forces. Nothing survived. Even if the Elder AI's canister was unharmed by the fall into the star, no technology existed in the galaxy to recover an object from inside a neutron star. It was lost forever.
"You idiot!"
screeched the commander of the 67th Fleet, directing her outrage at the enemy heavy cruiser that was accelerating away at impossible speed and soon would reach jump distance.
"You fools! You failed! Now neither of us has the artifact!"
An immediate response was not possible given the distances involved. Just before the heavy cruiser disappeared in a burst of gamma rays, a reply was sent.
"We warned you the artifact would be taken away from you." The spider's dry, raspy voice somehow sounded amused. "We said the Elder AI would be taken from you. We never said we would take it."
From a distance of 9 light hours, the Flying Dutchman's sensors watched the fall of our Vande station. That distance, greater than the span from Earth's sun to Pluto, was still uncomfortably close for Chang. He had agreed to bring his stealthy ship within range of the system's outer defense network only because they needed to know whether the operation was a success. Needed to know relatively soon after the event happened, for the longer they waited, the more Maxulk's ships might be buzzing around angrily searching for targets. Beginning 8.5 hours ago, Nagatha reported gamma ray signatures of multiple Maxulk's warships. Twice their position was swept by powerful active sensor pulses, the guardians of the star system not making any effort at concealment. The Maxulks wanted to know if anything hostile was in their territory, and they wanted to smash it. Roughly 1/2 hour after the enemy ship began the intensive search, Chang saw why. So did Scarantum. "That's the nice thing about a battle close to a neutron star," he observed while sipping a drink, because of course he was drinking at such a time. "The star cleans up the mess for you. No debris drifting around to become a navigation hazard." "That is an advantage, to be sure," Chang muttered while he manipulated the display controls. "Nagatha, can we confirm that the AI was in the station when it went down?"
"Unfortunately, no. It might have been different if Sam was a real Elder AI," she sniffed, still irritated that she had not originally known the truth about Bishop's deception.
Chang froze. He did not like hearing that.
"Different how? The Maxulks could determine the AI they lost isn't a true artifact?"
"No, dear," she sighed. "I misspoke. If Skippy had been aboard that station, he could have done some of his crazy space-time bending nonsense, but that ability is, as far as we know, unique to him."
"As he keeps telling us."
"I am able to confirm that the Maxulks certainly believe Sam went down with the station and has been lost. The data feeds from sections of the station continued until only a few minutes before those pieces impacted the surface of the star. That was quite a remarkable feat. I am impressed by the resilience of their technology. Though the data streams became unreliable, it is clear that the area of the station where Sam was stored did not survive the attack. Finally, I intercepted fragments of messages between Maxulk's ships requesting any known data on possible methods for recovering an object from the heart of a neutron star."
Chang nodded slowly. "The Kitties not only believe they lost an Elder AI, they know that Skippy claims he could survive falling into a star. Interesting. UNEF Command would be interested to hear that bit of information, and they would wonder how the enemy got that data. There would be another witch hunt by the counterintelligence people. Later."
"Bonus," Scarantum said through another loud slurp of his beverage. "The Maxulks will spend the next century consumed by a futile project to recover an artifact that never existed. I believe that is..." One of his antennas drew a checkmark in the air. "Phase 2 complete." Chang ran the video backward to watch the last pieces of our Vande station disappear. "Agree. Congratulations, Captain." He had learned enough of Jarap the body language to know their guest was unhappy. "What is wrong? I thought you would be happy about this."
"I am happy. I pulled off what is possibly the greatest scam in the history of the galaxy.
not only getting the Maxalks into a civil war, but also manipulating the Rindaloo into actually doing something, covering my tracks for me, and breaking the relationship between the Rindaloo and the hegemony government. All, he waggled an antenna at Chang, without firing a single shot. That is a successful operation. Then why are you not celebrating? Because I can't tell anyone about it. My people, even my own office, will think I simply got lucky that the Maxalks were plunged into a civil war. And now they will tell me I am supremely fortunate the Elder AI that I allowed to be captured by the enemy is no longer an imminent threat, but that is not due to any action by myself. I get no credit for this entire skillfully executed operation. This is so frustrating. I feel terrible for you, Chang muttered what he thought were the obligatory words for such an occasion. Perhaps you could drown your sorrows in a fine glass of bagoge. Well, the Jurathic considered, as if that notion had never occurred to him. I suppose I should at least try that remedy, if you insist.